listening to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Live from the Line Hotel in Washington, D.C., you're listening to The Tidbit, brought to you by Curate. I'm your host and the CEO of Curate, Kim Bryden. Do you run a small business or have dreams to start one? Well, here at The Tidbit, we've got your back. Each week, we talk through tidbits of knowledge around starting or running a small business with a food and beverage lens. And did you know that this show is based off of our bi-weekly newsletter that we send out at Curate? It's called The Tidbit, of course. And in it, we discuss what we're reading, eating, drinking, listening to, and learning. Five quick morsels of information to get you in the know and on top of your game. We have a send coming out this week, so head over to curate.co, C-U-R-E-A-T-E.co to sign up. One major opportunity I see for our local small business owners is your ability to drum up brand loyalty on a very hyper-local level, faster and with more sincerity than any major player in the space. And with that excitement about your brand, about your product, that means that you have a loyal following that you can then drive into locations to create sales. And this is ultimately what retailers are looking for. They need the foot traffic. They need the sales through their e-commerce channels. And by you building up your own following, your own tribe, you then not only are providing that quality product, but you're also providing a marketing engine for these bigger retailers and buyers to tap into. Think about that. It's important for you to know how your buyer is thinking about their business and how you can fit into their sales. I've said it before, and I'm going to say it again. Business is about solving problems. So what problem is that buyer facing, and how can you solve it? Each year, there's this huge natural foods trade show on the West Coast in California and the East Coast, typically in Baltimore, called Natural Products Expo East or West. And after this year's conference, a piece was written in a notable food publication called Food Dive titled, "Radical Collaboration Will Grow the Natural Organic Market." Color me intrigued. I am always down for radical collaboration. So the piece reads, "Consumers still lag behind corporate ability to influence, but they are gaining ground in the natural and organic market. And this is largely due to the rise of social media and growing consumer interest into the ingredients and production practices, such as regenerative farming, ethical livestock treatment, and sustainable agricultural systems that go into their food and beverages. Millennials show the most change in demand for a higher level of corporate responsibility among consumer groups, according to the Natural Marketing Institute data. 70% of this demographic completely or somewhat agreed that this was an issue they cared about in 2017, up from 65% in 2007. Huge. And it's not just social media itself that drives the sales. It's the consumer conversations it generates. You can have 10 million friends or followers, but if they don't share your stuff, it won't move the sales. And this is a quote from Jonah Berger, a professor at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania, who studies social influence. It takes resources, and if you're not willing to actively engage with consumers, it's not worth being there. You can't just tweet at people. You have to engage in a dialogue. And this strategy is especially crucial for the natural and organic space to drive growth, as the category can create dialogues on Twitter and Instagram to better explain the causes that these brands are founded upon. And this is what I'm saying. You, as a business owner, must practice what you preach. Create that loyalty in your following. This is what gets you on the radar of bigger organizations and also keeps you relevant and very top of mind for your current or even prospective customers. Live by what you stand for. I mean, isn't that, it's probably an Instagram quote somewhere, but it's true. You have to be authentic in what you're actually practicing, what you preach, right? And so there's no better example of this brand loyalty, this organic growth than Tsum Foods out of Philadelphia. And I am very excited to expand the Tidbits reach throughout the Mid-Atlantic with this week's guest, Shelby Zeitelman, CEO of Tsum Foods. So we're going to take a quick break and be right back with Shelby. You're listening to The Tidbit on Full Service Radio. We're here with Shelby Zeitelman, CEO of Tsum Foods. Welcome, Shelby.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
We are so glad to have you as well. And here on The Tidbit, we like to start with the foundations of starting and running your business before diving into the nitty-gritty. So Tsum, I mean, you're headquartered in Philadelphia, but you personally grew up in the DC metro area in Rockville, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what, in your view, has changed the most about the DC food and beverage space in the span of your memory and the new opportunities this presents to others, for yourself, but also for our listeners who are just starting out. And in particular, I'd really love to learn more about your thoughts, sort of compare and contrast the markets between Philadelphia and DC.
Well, you started with a pretty difficult question, to be honest, because I moved out of the DC metro area for college. So mm-hmm. I left when I was 18 years old. And I, you know, my family, we were not particularly foodies or that much in touch with the food scene in the DC area. Mm-hmm. We had an Italian restaurant that we frequented for dinner off of Rockville Pike. You know, we had like the standard places that we would go out to eat. So I wasn't really that familiar with the food scene while I lived there. But since I've left, we have had the opportunity to do a little bit of business in DC. And what I'm really pleased to see is the growing amount of ethnic and, as you were talking about, authenticity in the opening of, section of this podcast, mm-hmm. authentically ethnic restaurants opening up in the DC area, especially considering the highly international population throughout the DC metro area. Mm-hmm. And I believe that it is becoming a destination food town. Being in Philadelphia now, Philly has really put itself on the map with its food scene, and I do believe that DC is starting to catch up with really exciting new concepts and just kind of shaking up the norm as to what sorts of food options exist there.
Yeah. Is there anything that sort of strikes you immediately as something comparable or even very different between the two markets?
That's a great question. I like to say Philly's pretty raw. We're still very much a blue-collar town here. We like to refer to Philadelphia as the biggest little city, mm-hmm. you know, or the biggest small town in America. Like, folks grew up here. Like, it's a very, and stay here. It's not as transient as the D.C. area. Mm-hmm. And so with that, you know, it's not as polished per se. I think that leaves a little bit more room for creativity, and a lot of, you know, ethnic communities in the Philadelphia area. But as it compares to DC, you know, it's on a smaller scale as well, so it's a bit more accessible from a price point. But I am seeing a lot of creativity coming out of the DC market, and I think Philly's it's gonna have a competitor pretty soon.
Yeah, I think it's always so fascinating in the small town, big city vibes. I split my time between DC and Baltimore, and in Baltimore, it's colloquially Smalltimore.
Right.
And so being that, having that vibe, it's even more prevalent, this consumer brand loyal base that you're able mm-hmm. to build, because people want to grow and support the products that are made in their cities. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's a very collegial environment here in Philadelphia, whether that's on the brand side in consumer packaged goods or on the food service side. I really believe that people here are looking to help support one another. and help grow each other's businesses. And that was one of the reasons why we decided to start Zoom Foods in Philadelphia. We found the food service community to be a bit more accessible and not as competitive. Doors were open, and it wasn't as difficult to get meetings with head chefs or buyers to pitch our product and talk about the business opportunity that we had.
Oh, I love that. And let's dive into this further. So you, I mean, Zoom Foods, your staple product is tahini, and you mm-hmm. essentially came to tahini as an outsider a little bit. You have a business background, not necessarily a culinary one, and the product form you were drawn to, it, you know, it's native to a foreign country and culture, but you fell in love with it and you saw great potential to serve the U.S. market. And very often in entrepreneurship, as, you know, sort of this outsider status, also means the ability to offer a fresh creative solution. So I'm wondering, with your, you know, again, being a newbie to the industry, what was your newness? What about your newness did you see as an asset? And now that you've been in it for a few years, how do you sort of keep your curiosity and openness going as you continue to put forward new ideas and new solutions?
Mm-hmm. Well, you hit the nail on the head, as I was talking about in your first question. I'm not a foodie, was not raised in that environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love food, but did not know so much of the particularities of food when I was introduced to tahini. Mm-hmm. And yes, I personally was a bit of an outsider. My sister, though, and I'm in business with my two sisters, so my sister Jackie lives in Israel, and her husband, now husband, has been in the tahini industry and now sesame industry for 12 years. And
wow.
So he was actually the linchpin for us and the connection point to the product. He was selling tahini, Israeli manufactured tahini, throughout the country. And when they started dating, I had the opportunity to try the product, and it prompted me to ask a lot of questions. Mm. I was very confused about what this product was in Israel as compared to what I knew of tahini in the United States market. Again, didn't know that much, but I did know that it was this weird white sauce that you would put onto a falafel sandwich, or you might use it to make hummus. So I really did not know that much. And so through Omri and Jackie's relationship, had the opportunity to learn more about tahini and all the ways that it was used in Israel and throughout the Middle East and all of the amazing nutritional benefits, et cetera, et cetera. But to your point about being an outsider, that was something that really was an asset for us as we were building the business. We liked to joke that we were young and dumb, and that worked really well for us. And it enabled us to ask a lot of questions, to perhaps get meetings with folks that had been in the industry for a long time, because we really just wanted to learn as much as possible. We set up so many informational interviews in the first couple of months as we were building the business, and we were so pleasantly surprised to learn how much people were willing to sit down with us and talk about the industry and share with us, you know, their experiences to help us, you know, accelerate our business plan. So there was a lot that we didn't know. I found that one of the crucial pieces of being a business owner, entrepreneur, similar to what you were saying about solving problems, I think a lot of it for us was recognizing what we didn't know and hustling to find the answers.
Mm-hmm.
And often hustling to find the solutions, because that happens all the time. You know, so certain examples for us were, we didn't know about things like, honestly, we didn't know about the distribution system around
food
when we were starting.
Yes.
Yeah. So that was a big one. We didn't know about importing. When we first shared our business idea with our parents, my dad turned to us and asked, how are you going to import this product from Israel? And we said, we're not sure, but we'll figure it out. So we just worked really hard to find those answers and to figure out the solutions. And if we didn't have the core competency where we were able to, we would find someone who was able to assist us with that. So actually somebody that we worked with very early on, we didn't have that much money, but we worked with somebody to help us manage that whole international shipping, customs brokerage, warehousing piece of the business.
Wow.
And from there, we've grown immensely.
Wow, that's fantastic. And I would love to just get your thoughts in that stage when you're the most scrappy and agile, right? And mm-hmm. everything is so new. And like I was saying, that curiosity and openness you have because you are in this, you know, build sense. Now you've been in business for quite some time. So how has that sort of shifted away from maybe you're still scrappy and agile. I mean, when are we not as entrepreneurs? But, you know, how has that sort of shifted for you? And do you still try to integrate curiosity into your business practice?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question because it's interesting. Only being 5 years old, innovation becomes increasingly more difficult once you have processes and systems in place. And I always think about these big corporations whenever they need to make a change, how long that must take in order to implement.
Oh,
because
yeah.
something as seemingly simple as making a label change, for instance, that has implications across the board for our business now. So thinking through, okay, where does that label exist? It's not just on our packaging. It's in our marketing material. It's on our website. You know, thinking through the whole chain of events that needs to happen when you make a change. There's a lot to consider when bringing new innovation into the company. But we're always thinking about new ways to improve and new practices to bring in, new marketing tactics to pursue. We invest in professional development for our team, and so we encourage our team to attend events or continue, you know, online courses if they're able. Actually, one of our guiding principles as a company is this value of discovery.
Mm.
And so we're always encouraging all of us to discover new things, whether it be a new way to use tahini in your cooking or to learn about some of the history of the product or even to read a new sales book. Learning and continued education is a big piece of what we bring into our company because it's so much of what we have imparted onto our customers and the way we believe we've been able to develop a deeper connection with our customers through consumer education
mm-hmm.
and through, you know, connecting around this kind of shared learning about the product since it was so new to the United States market and is often so new to our customers, many of whom are just starting to use tahini for the first time. So that's a big, just overarching value of our company in all facets.
Ah, I love learning. and thank you for sharing that example of, you know, down to switching your label. And you may want to innovate around that, but you have to understand the implications across your supply chain now, like you said, not just in marketing collateral or on the packaging itself, but now where does that package live, not just on your online store, but in all of the retailers? And
mm-hmm.
how do you then switch out all of those mm-hmm. bottles across all of your channels? So that is what we are going to dive into next, this diversification of your sales channels. But we will take a quick break right now, and then we'll come right back with Shelby. You're listening to The Tidbit, and we're here with Shelby Zeitelman, CEO of Soom Foods. Hello, Shelby.
Hi, Kim.
Shelby, in a recent Food and Wine piece about your growth story, it reads, Soom's goal was to educate the consumer and make tahini a staple in American pantries, and to do it, they started with chefs. This is a fascinating strategy. So can you talk a little more about your work with the food service industry and what forming relationships with chefs looks like for you?
Yeah. So interestingly, I pulled up one of our early business plans recently, mm-hmm. just to reference it and see. I like to kind of check back in time to see how far we've come.
Oh,
and
yeah.
one of the kind of the paragraphs or the hypothesis that I put into our marketing strategy was around the food service community and how we believed if we got our product into the hands of chefs and onto menus, that that would help to accelerate the consumer education because it is a very expensive endeavor. And unfortunately, we did not have the type of money required to do a huge consumer education campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And we also did see it as a, you know, revenue, a source of revenue in its own right. But we did see it as this two-tiered approach. And so we were very fortunate that one of our early adopters of the product, actually, he was our first food service customer, is Mike Solomonov, who owns a very well-known restaurant group here in Philadelphia called Cook & Solo. And he loved our product and coincidentally was interviewed a few weeks later, maybe even a month later, about some of his favorite ingredients. And he referenced our product in a Wall Street Journal article.
Wow.
And yeah, it was so crazy. Like, we had fortunately just set up our online store to be able to receive orders, and I think we got something like 60 orders from that article. And my sister and I were just like, whoa, this is amazing. And then also, whoa, how do we fulfill these 60 orders? It was very, very funny.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking back to that moment in time. But yeah, this was at a moment, you know, back in 2013 where chefs were really gaining celebrity status. The Food Network, right, is 24 hours a day. I don't even know how many food channels there are now across TV and, you know, online, et cetera. But we were seeing this wave of chef as an influencer, as well as more information being shared on menus.
Mm-hmm.
So what you were talking about before with millennials wanting to know more about where their food is coming from and how it's being made, we were seeing that on menus in both fine dining and fast casual concepts that were calling out their suppliers. And so we thought maybe if chefs and restaurants could call out tahini, and more specifically, our brand of tahini, that would then trickle down to the consumer.
I love this. And just to now pull, you know, away from that first moment, is there a way in which you approach new business opportunities in this space now? Do you have any sort of go-to strategies or tips?
So we are still, so what ended up happening was the food service side of our business was generating significantly more revenue for our company than the consumer side, and it still is today. It's about 80-20.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And what a good lesson learned early on.
Yes, and a hard one, because when you start a business with a vision that your product is going to be on every grocery store shelf and you realize that that may not be the case, just, you know, kind of doing a deep dive into yourself and reflecting on what your business is versus what you thought it might be.
Yeah.
Not that it can't still become that, but it just, you know, it took a lot of soul searching and confidence to make that pivot.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still going through that conversation. But we, you know, so we decided to invest in our food service sales, and we brought on subsequently over the past 2 years, two internal sales reps to help fuel that growth. Amy, my business partner and sister, she oversees all of our business development. And then we have two sales reps who are responsible for both cultivating relationships with the end user, so the chef or the restaurant that's buying our product, as well as the distributors that are servicing those restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really two-tiered approach and a very sometimes complex relationship to navigate. Ultimately, we see our relationship and responsibility to the end user. We want to make sure that the restaurant or chef is getting the product that he or she is looking for. And we see our distributors as partners in the fulfillment of those orders. But, you know, distributor relationships are extremely important because they are the folks that are hitting the ground every day and representing the product. So it's really, really important for us to maintain a good relationship with our distributors, to also educate them and their sales reps about the product so that then they can go out in the field and represent our brand as well.
It is managing so many levels of relationships. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of complexity in relationships. And I mean, again, isn't that what business is ultimately about? Relationship building.
It really is. And that's something that we maintain and hold to a very high standard in our business. Mm-hmm. We take customer feedback, our conversations with any individual that we have a relationship with. Transparency is another one of our guiding values. I mean, we are honest and open about anything, whether that's good or that's bad. We want to be in connection with and conversation with the people that we work with, and ultimately we want them to know that we are trustworthy and reliable, because without that mutual understanding, they could choose any other tahini. I mean, our tahini, we believe, is exceptional and high quality, but there's a reason why people choose to do business with us, and I maintain that that is, you know, aspects of our business that goes beyond just the product itself.
Oh, definitely. And just to go into some of these nuts and bolts, I mean, I think a lot of times our listener, an entrepreneur, may sort of waffle in their business confidence, because when you're going from a single sales channel, for instance, you know, farmer's market, or you were just doing direct to consumer online sales, and then you have to start building up these different sales channels, I mean, the levels of complexity increase. Mm-hmm. And we've discussed this many times, you know, on previous episodes of The Tidbit, but just because a certain distribution opportunity exists doesn't always mean it's necessarily the right fit for your business either. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering, because you now sell via multiple channels, like we just talked about food service, you do have an online store, retailers, how have you decided where and when to be, and are there any sort of critical capabilities you've worked to have in place at each step of this process?
Yeah. So speaking again to our decision to focus on food service versus, you know, consumer, that was taking a hard look at our books and realizing that food service was bringing in more revenue. And so that was a very hard decision to make, but it was one based on data. And we then made the decision to invest in more sales staff and support in order to grow that piece of the business. And what we've learned still being in both of these worlds, right, like the professional chef and the food service and culinary side of the business, as well as the at-home chef and, you know, this whole consumer-facing world, they are different languages. And they require different sales pitches and different, you know, an understanding of what that end user is looking for. And even within those two worlds, that breaks down even further. And so I really believe it's about understanding what the end user values, what he or she is looking for, and creating that point of connection authentically, right? Like not promising something that isn't there, right? If price is a non-negotiable and we can't reach that, we're never going to be able to sell to someone that's looking to buy tahini for $40 a bucket, let's say. Mm-hmm. But if you are able to meet the customer where they're at, then hopefully you're able to identify that shared attribute and, you know, and create a relationship accordingly.
You know, this is probably a lesson I have been learning my whole life, but wow, has it been so obvious to me this year, in that we're all speaking English, except we're definitely speaking different languages, especially in this context of, like we were saying, managing all of these relationships. They're fundamentally different jargon, you know, the way in which people are describing what they're offering, even though it may actually be the same thing you are saying, they're just using different terminology. And that, like, ability to sort of code switch between the different relationships you have. I mean, it's so crucial. And I think you just learn it over time, probably.
Yeah, you learn it over time, and you learn it just by trying. You don't know what attributes or product qualities people are looking for until you start to have the conversation. And I do think that that's one of the things that has, well, I won't say it's been easier for us to penetrate the food service channel, because each channel has its own challenges, but for us, there is more of a conversation in the food service world versus on a grocery store shelf, in which kind of your label has to speak for you, or the customer goes in knowing what he or she is looking for. And so that has allowed us sometimes to start the conversation just by asking a lot of questions and not even pitching anything, so that we can hear what the chef is looking for. And sometimes it was things like, you know, usability. Our tahini is easier to reblend. And we've learned over the years that that was something that was a huge pain point for many chefs and many kitchens, that when the tahini that they were previously using separated between the oil on the top and the sludge on the bottom, it was taking someone in their kitchen a long time to reblend that. Mm. And so we were saving their kitchen staff time and headache, and therefore giving their kitchen more yield of the product, which was a huge asset and something that we honestly never even considered before we learned that, you know, a couple of years ago. So that's since become a selling attribute that we can discuss in our conversations.
Fantastic. And to sort of bring this full circle, you had mentioned that going into food service, you had seen it as not just a sales channel, but also that consumer education. And you know, maybe it's fair to say that tahini is a little misunderstood as a product in the U.S. So education's really important. We've already talked about our love of learning. But sometimes this need to educate a target audience can feel like a barrier to entry. But you've really, I personally feel you've really made it such an opportunity. I mean, you have what? 16,000 followers, 16,000 plus followers on Instagram now. Like, I just think you've been able to combine, again, this strategy of sales and education so beautifully. So I'm wondering, in closing, one, how can people follow you and stay in touch with you? But also, can you talk a bit more about this experience and share any relevant tips you have for success that might help our listeners?
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that. That means so much coming from you, and it's something we've worked really hard on, so that means a lot. The best way to find our company is online, www.sumfoods.com, or at sumfoods is all of our handles, Instagram, Facebook, et cetera. I think that the way we've been able to educate is that we have tried to do very little of the talking and not asked, but invited folks to share their opinions about our product for us. And that has created what we found to be a more authentic connection with consumers when they hear something from someone that they're already following versus hearing it from us that they don't necessarily have a relationship with yet. They're more likely to trust the source that they already trust. Mm. And so we've worked a lot with influencers, whether those are chefs or whether those are social media, you know, personalities that have a certain following, that we've shared our product with them. They genuinely love the product and have been willing to share about that. That's helped us to accelerate the education. And it's across all different types of platforms and medium. So there are those in the foodie world that have developed a connection with our product because they've followed a certain chef. Or there are people in the health and wellness world that have learned about our product because they follow a certain, you know, health and wellness Instagram account. And so that has been a really amazing experience to build that community all around, you know, one product, but for very different reasons. People are learning about it understanding its versatility, its health benefits, whatever point of connection they're looking to make, then ultimately they have decided to follow our brand and develop a direct connection there.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Shelby, for your time and for all of your insight. I know our listener is going to gain so much from your business journey. So thank you. And listener, if you have any topics that you'd like us to discuss around starting a small business with a food and beverage lens, let us know. Head over to curate.co, curate.co, and say hello. And until next time, remember to scale thoughtfully and source locally.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.